Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, Mark Arax joins us to talk about his new piece, A Kingdom of Dust, about billionaire Valley farmers Stuart and Linda Resnick. We'll learn how they grew their ag empire on water and creative marketing. We'll also learn why NASA is getting involved in the local air quality game and using some of the same air quality sensors that you can buy and put right outside your home. We begin today's Valley Edition, though, with a special investigative report. Government buildings are usually pretty easy to spot, with big signs featuring their names and logos. Even agencies with some of the most sensitive information share their whereabouts. But in downtown Fresno, one government office flies so far under the radar that most who walk past would never know what's behind its mirrored glass windows. And as FM 89's Carrie Klein reports, the secretive nature of this office is drawing concern from immigration lawyers and advocates.
The building is on L Street downtown. It looks pretty innocuous. Beige brick, red trim, and tall reflective windows. There's no sign on the door. In fact, nothing at all out front except the street number, a wheelchair accessible sticker, and a key card reader with an intercom. But there are security cameras, at least seven of them on the building, and a handful of roll-top garage doors where government vehicles pull in and out. On the day I visit, a van parked out front reads Department of Homeland Security.
It's really a building with some mirror windows across a hotel, and you have no idea that it's actually a federal agency in there.
Angelica Salceda is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union in Fresno. She's never been inside the building, but her clients have.
What we know of is from different stories that people have shared of where they end up getting processed.
Getting processed. This office is run by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, a division of Homeland Security. It's neither an administrative office nor a long-term detention center, but something in between. Like Salceda said, a processing center for individuals ICE believes are in the country illegally.
If someone gets detained here in Fresno or a nearby county, they'll likely get sent to the L Street location, get processed. From there, that's when they would be sent to another detention facility.
It's a waypoint for new detainees before being moved to longer-term facilities or being deported. As far as we know, what's happening here is not illegal, and it's not all that uncommon. But this facility, like many, is completely unmarked. It's not listed on the ICE website. Like Salceda, most attorneys we spoke to found out about it only through clients. And this shroud of secrecy has lawyers and advocates concerned about due process and civil rights. The office is at 733 L Street, near Bitwise and the Hilton DoubleTree. According to a lease obtained by Valley Public Radio, it's about 10,000 square feet in size, and the U.S. government rents it from United Security Bank. As for what's inside, the ICE press office was unresponsive to multiple interview requests for this story. So I decided to visit the office myself. At about 9:30 a.m. last Thursday, I walked up to the mirrored front door and rang the buzzer.
Hello, how can I help you?
Hi there. Yeah, I'm a reporter with Valley Public Radio, and I was just curious if this is an Immigration and Customs Enforcement office?
It sure is.
Okay, great. I was wondering, I asked a few questions. If I could get a tour, why there's no sign, what they do here, and he politely deflected all of them. He finally cut me off after about 30 seconds.
Okay, that's going to be it, ma'am.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Thanks. I couldn't get inside, but someone who has is Camille Cook. She's an immigration attorney in Fresno. She says, picture waiting in the reception area of a tiny doctor's office.
And there's like a window there where you would think that there would be a person that would be helping people, but there's no person at the window. And then there's a locked door, And so you basically sit there and wait for somebody to come out of the door.
Another immigration attorney recalled seeing three or four holding cells beyond that locked door. ICE does not make much information public about its facilities or detainees, but within data provided by the agency via the Freedom of Information Act, we found a detention center known as the Fresno Hold Room that may be this facility. Some local attorneys have heard this name, others haven't, but their client stories are consistent with hold room policies, which state detainees can be held no longer than 12 hours. According to the data, in an 11-month period of 2015, close to 1,100 detainees passed through the Fresno hold room. Another 2,600 passed through a hold room in Bakersfield. Those are two out of a network of 100 hold rooms used throughout the U.S. that year, within a total of more than 600 short and long-term facilities. On ICE's website, however, the agency lists only 112 detention centers, and none of them are hold rooms. Cook argues this lack of transparency extends beyond basic public information. The families of detainees don't always know where their loved ones are. And in many cases, Cook says ICE may transfer her clients out of the Fresno facility before she can get there to speak with them.
They are not a service agency, and they are not very friendly to attorneys. And that can make it extremely difficult sometimes to try to make sure that my clients receive the due process that they have a right to under the Sixth and Fourth Amendments of the U.S. Constitution.
Detainees may spend an insignificant amount of time at these facilities, but significant things happen there. Hamid Yazdan is a Berkeley-based immigration attorney and a member of a new regional rapid response network that aims to keep attorneys on call for new detainees. Those first few hours of detention are critical because, he says, that's when detainees may be coerced into signing away their rights.
Someone may waive their right to a hearing in front of a judge, or they may waive their right to actually explore and articulate why they're afraid to return to their home country. And if they do waive those rights, they may be deported.
Clara Long is an attorney with the non-governmental organization Human Rights Watch. She studies human rights abuses against non-U.S. citizens, and secretive ICE facilities like these have long been on her radar.
You know, if you wanted to limit people's access to attorneys, then this is the system that you would set up.
She echoes local attorneys' concerns about due process. She's especially concerned because language in the agency's draft 2018 budget asks to increase the time limit that detainees can spend in short-term facilities.
That ask is indicative of an administration that's sort of ramping up to use short-term detention even more than it's currently being used.
But whether ICE will ever provide enough information for us to know about it is another question. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess also contributed to this report. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. By some measures, Stuart Resnick is the biggest farmer in California. His empire of almonds, pomegranates, pistachios, and citrus covers over 120,000 acres in the San Joaquin Valley. Known today as the Wonderful Company, Resnick and his wife Linda have grown their multi-billion dollar fortune on products like Palm Wonderful pomegranate juice and Wonderful Halo's mandarin oranges. And despite California's drought, in recent years they've kept growing, thanks in part to shrewd management of their most precious resource, water. Now, in a new piece for the California Sunday magazine, journalist Mark Arax digs deep into the story of the Resnicks, their fortune, philanthropy, and their control of water in California's agricultural heartland. It's a preview of his upcoming book on water in the Golden State and offers a rare inside look into the wonderful empire. Mark Arax joins us now in our studio. Mark, welcome.
Hey, Joe.
California has had no shortage of land barons and agriculture titans, people like Henry Miller, J.G. Boswell. Are Stuart and Linda Resnick just the next link in that chain, or are they something different?
I think they're the next link in the chain. I also think there's something different. You have to go back to the wheat kings, Isaac Friedlander, in the 1870s to find farmers who really weren't farmers. I mean, the wheat kings all lived on Nob Hill in San Francisco. and from afar they kind of managed the land. Henry Miller was also, you know, an industrialist from San Francisco, but he had his finger on the operation quite a bit, on that horse, you know, up and down, the cattle king. You still see his imprint there on Los Banos and Firebaugh and places like that, Mendota. I think the Resniks are different because of the crops they're growing. They're really high-end things. And then they've wedded that growing to the marketing. So you see a kind of coming together of L.A. hype culture and San Joaquin Valley farming culture. And they've done things in a way that I think breaks some of those molds. And I also think that the philanthropy they're doing is extraordinary. Boswell did a lot of philanthropy, especially in and around Corcoran. The football stadium, the local hospital, senior citizen center. But the Resniks have, you know, they're doing something quite a ways beyond that.
You write that Resnik got where he is today because he's a gambler. It's been one especially lucky streak, has it not?
Well, he says it's all luck. I think that's probably, you know, maybe a third of it. Good timing, good luck, but also being smart about things and then having his wife there. I mean, she's a pretty extraordinary marketer. So the combination of the two of them. And if you see the way the piece really deals with it, and the book really deals with how they built this empire. And, you know, it started, I mean, Stuart Resnik is, you know, his father owned a bar in New Jersey. And he said he would come home and sometimes the car wouldn't be there. His dad had lost it in a gambling bet. So he comes west in 1956 and then starts off at UCLA Law School. And by the time he's finished, he started up these cleaning businesses in L.A., and he's well on his way to being a millionaire right there. And then just one thing morphs into another. And then it's not until the late 70s that he comes up and over the mountain to the valley and decides to invest in some farmland in Delano, you know, where the Cesar Chavez movement started.
So why agriculture for him? He could have put that money into just about anything, real estate, other investments, which he also did. But why agriculture? And how does this kid from New Jersey, who presumably hasn't driven a tractor, manage to become such a titan of valley agriculture?
I think what happened is he just saw a good deal in Delano on some citrus ground and a packing house and figured, well, this is land and, you know, it's a hedge against inflation. And that's how we started. And then the profits were like crazy those first few years. I mean, who knows what would have happened if you'd have hit a drought right away or a bad streak or something like that. He didn't. And he bought land for pretty cheap from the oil companies who were, you know, not really farmers anyhow. They planted stuff. So he bought it for cheap. And it just, you know, kind of one thing led to the other. And that stitching together that empire is also something that, you know, I delve into how it was done. And, you know, it's at the point today where he doesn't even know how many acres he's really farming. I mean, it changes all the time. He owns 180,000 acres of California real estate, you know, land. 121,000 of those acres are now being farmed. You know, he's the biggest pistachio, almond, citrus, and pomegranate grower in the world. And then he processes all those as well. So he's not only controlling his nuts, but he's controlling the nuts of other growers, okay? So, you know, almonds and pistachios that he's processing for, you know, so he controls, especially in pistachios, he controls 40% of the marketing of pistachios, of the whole trade.
And it's not just crops that he controls, but also water.
Yes.
How did he managed to gain such an influential role in managing, or at least have such power over water resources in the state?
You have to look at his land throughout the valley. And he's even gone into the wine country too, both in North and in Paso Robles. So he's farming in areas that draw from the Central Valley Project, the federal project. He's farming in areas that draw from the State Water Project. Then he's farming in areas where the groundwater is good and he can pump it. And then he's farming in areas where there's no groundwater and he has to depend on the state system. And in flood years, he's able then to take some extra water and park it in a water bank in Kern.
Which he controls.
Which he controls. The water bank was a state project. The taxpayers of California jump-started it with $74 million. But the state really couldn't get its act together on this. And Kern County wanted local control. So the state not having its stuff together and the county then resisting ended up in a situation where, well, who was going to run this water bank? Who was going to control it? And they had a series of secret meetings in Monterey. And as part of these, the back and forth trading, the Resnick Empire basically ended up controlling the water bank. They have a 50-55% interest in that. So they're able to draw on that. But the problem with our last drought was it was 5 years, 6 years, and they used up all the water in the water bank or all the water that they could get out of it. And then the state water project 1 year didn't deliver any water and in 2 other years really cut back on it. So the question became is how is this empire watering its crops? And so when I went to Lost Hills in Kern County, over the last few years, that was the question on my mind. I mean, they had record harvests on their trees, and I couldn't understand for the life of me how that was happening given the lack of water.
And you found a pipe.
I found a pipeline. Field man at Wonderful saw me driving around. I was skulking around in these areas out there in the middle of nowhere. And, I told him my dilemma, and he said, well, go next to the California Aqueduct off a road called Twisselman, and you will see a pipeline. It's a private off-the-books pipeline, and it's bringing water from 40 miles away into the orchards of Wonderful, into Resnick's orchards. And so I use that kind of mystery of where that water is coming from, where it's going to, who set it up, as a way to tug you through this narrative. Because it's a long narrative.
And we'll get into that in a little bit and maybe some cracks that might be appearing in the empire of Wonderful. So much of this is about marketing, though. You drive down Highway 99, as you describe, in Delano, and you see the giant new facility there for Halos and that four-story box. That's Linda Resnick's idea,
yeah.
I take it. And a lot of these things are her idea.
Yeah, really smart. It was just a storage place. So what she does is she decides, well, this is four stories. With some lighting, it could be quite dramatic. And it looks like an almighty box of halos up there. And so you're driving, and you're not sure, what it is, but it's a box of halos with the fruit peeking out, and they have halos on them. Wonderful piece of advertising. All that marketing from the pomegranate juice to the Wonderful pistachios and almonds to Fiji water, that's all, a lot of it comes, started with Linda. She's got a crew now and everything else, but she's still very hands-on on that. So they're this really extraordinary, interesting, quirky couple. There are not a lot of Jewish farmers in the Valley. There are not a lot of farmers from New Jersey and New York in the Valley. There are not a lot of husbands and wives running agricultural enterprises in the Valley. So they're breaking the mold in so many ways.
Breaking the mold also in Lost Hills. The community you describe in this piece in the California Sunday Magazine has to be one of the most unusual communities in Central California. You write about seeing what is essentially a modern-day company town there and the elaborate lengths the Resnicks have gone to put their touch on just about everything there. And you write, the believer and the skeptic do their tussle inside my head. Which one won out?
The story is, the two chapters in the book are very conflicted on this question about, benevolence and philanthropy and what's being gained and what's being gamed, And so I'm not sure where it ends up. It ends up in that kind of muddy middle, like I say. I mean, it's not one way or the other. So let me explain that. Lost Hills was essentially a company town for 20-some years. At some point late in the game, in the last 5 years, the Resniks decided to start really donating money to that place. And not just Lost Hills, to some of the other communities like Avenal and Delano, where their workers are. And it's not small giving. You know, you're looking at charter schools. You're looking at, you know, housing. You're looking at infrastructure, streets, sidewalks. The charter schools, you know, Linda's not just writing checks out and then handing them to someone. She's writing the checks, and then she's actually designing the programs and the schools themselves, you know, from the architecture to the curricula. Linda's designing it, with the help of some experts, of course. But this is not hands-off philanthropy, and that's what's so remarkable about it. But it's got its creepy elements, too. I mean, in the fight against obesity and diabetes in their workforce, they have a cafeteria that serves these very delicious and healthy meals for $3. And she's selling fruits and vegetables out of that restaurant as well. And she's encouraging them to change their diet, you know, telling them that flour tortillas are as bad for you as a can of Coca-Cola. So the philanthropy almost becomes kind of a social engineering in a way. And so you leave there conflicted about it. And so you go to the park and you see in this town, this wonderful park, and I'm double entendre there, but it is wonderful, but it's so perfect. And then you look and you see the branding of it is the wonderful park. And then the O in the wonderful is shaped like a heart, the same heart you see in the bottle of the palm. So it's philanthropy, it's hands-on philanthropy, but it's also philanthropy with a certain level of branding. And that's what makes it complicated to kind of unpack. And so if there's that tussle that I'm talking about in my brain, the skeptic and the believer, that tussle, I think, carries through the entire chapters in the book and in the piece, the magazine piece.
With someone so influential and powerful as Stuart Resnick and Linda as well, as they are partners in this, what do other people think? Let's start with those people in Lost Hills. What did the workers, the residents there in this company town, what did they share with you about the boss man, essentially?
Yeah.
What do they think?
Well, they really like the boss lady. I mean, she's coming in and delivering stuff and making their lives better. There is some pushback to some of the health things they're trying to do in the company. You know, they've got a gym there, and they've got these incentive programs where if you lose a certain amount of weight, you get money. And so there's a little pushback on that. They feel it's a little too coercive. But there's also folks who feel it's quite good, and it's changed lives. And there's folks who look around town and say, this place is different with this philanthropy. And how could it not be? That's $50 million a year in some cases. The school in Delano is, you know, the finest charter school in the middle of the state. So, and then she's, you know, when those kids graduate and they go off to college, oftentimes with Resnick scholarships. And when Linda noticed that, you know, half the kids were dropping out of school in college, she then decided, well, you know, we need to commit tutors to them in all parts of the state. So there are these Resnick tutors that are serving, and not just tutors, they're kind of life coaches in a way, serving these kids as they go off to college. So this is all singular. It's never been done before. And how do you look inside someone's heart and say, what's the motive? Well, you know, the motive of philanthropy has been complicated in our country since the first giver. I mean, you know, you look at all the robber barons who created libraries and everything else for us, you know, the J.P. Morgans and the Rockefellers and everything. And so there's probably a little guilt to giving, but there's also this idea that this place is the conditions here after, you know, a century of agriculture, kind of a plantation kind of culture, there's a lot of need And so they're trying to fill that up. And they're challenging other growers to maybe do the same.
And what do other farmers think about the Resniks?
I think they're a little intimidated by the giving. As I said, Boswell established a real sense of philanthropy. But a lot of agriculture here, a lot of the big farmers, they don't live in the communities they're farming. And that's a real issue. Because when you're not living in a place, you're not invested in that place. You know, you're driving out there or you're flying out there and landing and doing your agriculture, but you're coming back to Northwest Fresno to live. And so there's this disconnect between you and your land in a way. Even as you're farming it, there's this disconnect. It's a psychological disconnect. It's a geographic disconnect. And so our farmers over the decades have given to Fresno State, they've given to Valley Children's Hospital, they've given to St. Agnes. But giving to the communities that they farm in has not really happened to the degree that the Resniks believe it should. And so they're setting this example. And I think it's making folks take a second look.
What about on the business side, though, especially when you combine that with water? Do the Resniks throw their weight around in the industry to advance their own agenda? How do other farmers out there, whether they're pistachio growers or their neighbors, especially given the massive amount of pumping that goes on?
Well, they absolutely throw their weight around. You know, a lot of rival pistachio growers consider Stuart Resnick a bully because he controls the market and dictates things. There are small farmers just in the Kings River area where their pumps are drying up because Resnick is able to go deeper into the ground and outpump them. So, you know, the other way that Resnick survived the drought, as it turns out, is he ended up buying an extraordinary amount of water from water-rich irrigation districts, surplus here and there. He spent $200 million during the drought buying water. It pencils out because these crops, especially pistachios, are, you know, bringing in an extraordinary return.
But there are some cracks that are starting to appear in the empire. You write about seeing pomegranate orchards that are no longer in production being torn out right now and a glut of the palm wonderful juice in their tanks. What's going on here? What is happening? And is this a turn of fortune or just a minor bump in the road?
It's a great question. What I explore in over the last 4 years in the book that will, you know, hopefully come out later this next year, and in this magazine piece, is that question of, have we extended agriculture too far in the San Joaquin Valley? If you look at the development of agriculture in the valley, we started with the best land, and now we are planting almonds and pistachios in land that used to not even be suitable for cattle grazing. And we're doing that because of drip irrigation. Drip irrigation is allowing you to deliver water and nutrients and all that to a little narrow root zone. And so the return on nuts, now almonds have gone down, but they went down almost by half, but now they're coming back up again. But the return is such that they can afford to do all this pumping and everything. But there's a mining of groundwater going on that, you know, I'm sure you guys have covered already, but I really dig down deep into this. I mean, the subsidence that's happening right now, I mean, the land is sinking no longer by inches, it's by feet. And so agriculture has, because of Resnick and other big growers, and now hedge funds that are coming in and everything else, it has extended its footprint beyond what the water can cover. And so we're going to see a correction that's going to be massive and unprecedented in valley agriculture. We're going to see probably when the groundwater laws go into effect, which could be another decade or so, but we could see a fallowing of 1 million to 2 million acres of farmland in the Central Valley.
So Stuart Resnick is a smart businessman. He knows what's going on in Sacramento, the Groundwater Act, SGMA as it's called, in this part of the state that was passed, what was that, 2014, 2015 or so? And again, it's still being implemented. But he has to have his eye not just out 1 year or even 5 years, but 10 years or more. Is he thinking about the sustainability of his operation, both internally, as he is now in his 80s, but also on the environment and natural resources side? Is this a sustainable business?
Yeah, I think what happened during the drought is ultimately they pulled out a lot of acres of pomegranates and 10,000 acres of almonds in Lost Hills. At the end of the piece, I ask him, you know, what's the lesson of the drought? And initially he says, well, what lesson? I mean, it's a drought. You know, the story of California is drought and flood, so you better be prepared for drought. And he really wasn't. He had planted all the way to his margins and beyond. You know, the farmers call that wall-to-wall planting, and that's what they did. And so they had to cut back. And he said, when I pushed him some more, he said, well, the lesson of drought is we want to be in areas that are served by either the State Water Project or the Central Valley Project, plus we want to be in areas that have groundwater. Now, Kern County, Lost Hills, western Kern County, Lost Hills, there's no groundwater out there. So he is wholly dependent on the State Water Project and whatever he can bank in flood years. And that's why he overextended himself. So I think the Resnick Empire already is correcting. Now, we had a flood year last year. They're starting to replant again. But as they're replanting, we're in the midst of perhaps another drought year. And climate change, and the farmers that I talk to acknowledge that it's climate change. The cycles are coming back. And we're cycling through a lot faster than we used to. And it could be that we're going to return to a pattern of drought again. And in that case, you have to have the ability to have a state project, groundwater, and also enough money from the commodities you're selling to buy water on the open market from the rice growers in Sacramento, for instance.
Now, Stuart and Linda Resnick are not the only billionaire farmers in your piece, or even in the Valley for that matter. Let's bring up John Vidovich as we bring this to a close. What role does he play and has a bit of a complex relationship with Stuart Resnick, does he not?
So as I'm tracing this pipeline that is moving water from Tulare County into Resnick's fields in Kern County, I'm wondering where the water is coming from and who is actually, you know, harvesting it. Well, it turns out that it's John Vidovich, who's a Silicon Valley developer. The family had farmland way back before the Silicon chip. The father developed a lot of the Silicon Valley into houses and things like that. John, who's 60, came up and over the mountain, decided he's going to build an empire here. And what he started doing is buying up a lot of farmland. He owns about 100,000 acres, but he's not farming a lot of it. He's not farming the ground. What he is farming the water. And he's been selling some of that water to the city. Very controversial sales. So the farmers are watching Vidovich closely, not sure what he's up to, but they fear that he's buying land and he's going to strip the water off that land and then send it up and over the mountain, you know. And so what you see is that he and Resnick were at war, and then in this drought they made some peace, and Vidovich decides to deliver some water to Resnick in the worst of the drought to get him through it. And that's what this pipeline, the story of this pipeline, shows, this kind of secret handshake that these two guys do. And is Vidovich a billionaire? He's pretty close. And so it's these two, you know, a near billionaire and a billionaire, or a billionaire and a billionaire.
Hard to know.
Yeah, together and making this thing happen. And that's what I discovered. And that's kind of the mystery that tugs you through the piece.
Is that deal legal?
The farmers in Tulare County whose groundwater is being extracted and then sent two counties over would say it isn't and have sued. And there's a settlement that says he can only take a certain amount of water, but it has to remain within that basin. Well, this water went outside that basin. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't make that call, but it's an interesting question.
Again, we're talking with Mark Erex today on Valley Public Radio. With all of the things that are going on in California and water, we have the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project. Those deliveries are likely never to be what they once were, now that we have environmental considerations that have taken into account that weren't taken in back when those projects were designed. With that in mind, with Sigma in mind, are we going to see more of this, more of what Vidovich is doing, selling off water maybe to another farmer outside the area, or even beyond that, what he did back in 2009 and selling $73 million worth of water to a district over in San Bernardino County? In some way, does the new regulatory environment that we're in almost precipitate the decline of not only Valley agriculture, but maybe shipping what water is left outside the area? Is that a real fear?
So, way back when had we decided to develop agriculture by taking 70% of our river flow and then leaving the other 30% in, we would have developed an agriculture that was sustainable, wouldn't have the kinds of crop gluts that we have, raisin busts and nut busts and fruit busts and all those kinds of things. But we decided to take all the river. Then we decided to take the groundwater. And then when that ran out, we said, bring us a river, steal us a river from afar. And so came the flows of the Sacramento River, the surplus flows. So we were not sustainable a long time ago. So with all this pressure that's happening, it's going to impinge on agriculture. And I think it's going to develop an agriculture in the valley initially that's a lot more sustainable. It's going to be in high-end crops. You're going to see alfalfa probably not grown as much. Cotton not as grown as much. That's already happening. And you're going to see acreage come down. Westland's 600,000 acres, now 500,000 acres, will probably end up being 300,000 acres. But it'll be productive and it'll be a lot closer to sustainability. The next step is the tragic step. And what happens is the water becomes more valuable than the crops, and these guys decide to strip the water from the land and sell it to developers in the valley and developers up and over the mountain. And the question becomes is, will this farmland be paved over like we see so much of it being paved over now? And I think ultimately that's where we're going to go. Nothing has stopped the houses up till now. And unless we have some kind of state law that draws a line around agriculture and says you cannot convert these into suburbia, we're going to see the same slow creep happen. And it won't be in our lifetimes, but maybe our grandchildren's lifetimes, where this place will follow the story of Los Angeles.
You've been pursuing this story for years now, pursuing Stuart Resnick for years, and got the cold shoulder for many years, had his secretary hang up on you many times. Why do you think he decided to talk?
I think Linda didn't want him to talk, but I think he basically said, look, he's going to do this thing anyhow. We might as well get our 2 cents in. And, you know, I try to be fair in this piece. And you asked early on about this kind of messiness, this conflict. Is it black or is it white? And it isn't. It's in the beautiful gray. And so I think he decided to talk just simply to get his story out. And when he did talk at the end, it changed a lot of my story. I was told about all this philanthropy where they were doing, and the piece suddenly, and the book suddenly reflects all of that. Had he not allowed me in to see that, I think the piece would have missed that element.
So where does Resnick go from here? He's in his 80s. What's the plan?
He looks good, man. He's drinking a lot of pomegranate juice. I don't know. You ask him that, and I don't think he knows yet. The sad thing is, if this gets, you know, taken up by some, you know, gets put in a trust and then some hedge fund takes it over, they're not going to have the same investment in the land that he and Linda do. And that's an odd thing to say because they're over in Beverly Hills. They live in Beverly Hills, and their company town is in Lost Hills. There's 140 miles as the crow flies distance. But if that goes to some investors in New York, they're just going to strip it. They're going to be strippers. And so I think it'll be a sad day to see that happen. I hope he hangs on to 100.
You can find Mark Arax's new piece about the lives and agriculture and water of Stuart and Linda Resnick in the California Sunday magazine. There's also a link on our website at kvpr.org. And we await that book, hopefully coming out next year, about California water. Mark, thanks so much.
Thanks, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A few weeks ago, we told you how new, high-tech, low-cost air quality sensors are helping Valley residents monitor air pollution right outside their homes. But the devices aren't being used just by homeowners. They're also being adopted by some of the world's top scientists. FM89's Laura Tsutsui reports NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory is testing the devices here in the Valley in preparation for investing pollutants from space.
On a rooftop in central Fresno stands a forest of air quality monitors. Pipes stick out from the roof, and they're attached to around a dozen silver and white instruments that look almost like streetlights. They're measuring everything from the size of particulate matter to ozone. This site, run by the California Air Resources Board, is home to most of the instruments that inform Fresno residents of their air quality. And now, this roof is also home to a purple air monitor. The white plastic sensor is smaller than a coffee mug. It hardly stands out next to the other instruments, but it's doing almost the same job as the machine next to it, measuring particulate matter. David Diner is a senior research scientist at JPL. His team placed this sensor and a few others around the Central Valley.
And what we're interested in is looking at atmospheric aerosols. And these are tiny particles that are suspended in the air. And these particles affect our climate, and they also affect our health when we breathe them.
The purple air sensors are consumer-level monitors that measure particulate matter. While the airborne sensors cost thousands of dollars, the purple air costs a little over $200. They're pretty accurate, but some do warn the data may skew high. Right now, that purple air sensor JPL has in Fresno is mounted right next to another particle counter so they can compare the readings. Depending on how it performs, JPL may set up more purple air monitors to help with a new research project.
We're also developing a new instrument called the Multi-Angle Imager for Aerosols, or MAIA, M-A-I-A, that would launch early in the next decade.
Part of JPL's mission is to use robots and satellites to explore space, but they also use them to explore Earth. This particular mission is to determine the makeup of particulate matter using the MAIA instrument in space and monitors on the ground. Later, they'll use health records to look at how that particulate matter affects health. Bart Ostro is a research professor at UC Davis. He's one of the epidemiologists working with JPL right now to determine which communities the MAIA instrument will focus on.
It's going to be looking at a lot of air pollutants that for parts of the world have never been measured because many of the countries that they'll be flying over, orbiting over, simply don't have the resources and the infrastructure to develop monitors of high quality and consistency.
Ostro says this study is the first of its kind because it's bringing together ground-level data, information from space, and health outcomes.
I have found that even though there's many studies in the U.S., a lot of countries will not really take notice and take this seriously until and unless you publish studies using local data. And once you show that, our own people are susceptible, that often gets the public and policymakers engaged.
Kevin Hamilton is CEO of the Central California Asthma Collaborative. He agrees that JPL's study may help them advocate for stronger regulations against local air pollution.
Yeah, we really have very good information right now, so I don't expect anything stunning, but I am hoping that we again just have more complete data.
Hamilton says studies have already been done to show the negative health effects of bad air in the valley. But the greatest benefit from JPL's study may be revealing a connection between the types of particulate matter that create certain health outcomes.
I think the exposure assessments that you're talking about from public health are the most difficult because no one writes on a death certificate, for instance, air pollution, caused this death.
While JPL is preparing for this study, there is some doubt over the future of NASA's Earth Science mission. President Trump's nominee for NASA Administrator, Congressman Jim Bridenstine, has expressed skepticism that humans are the main cause of climate change. In the past, he introduced legislation that could reduce NASA's Earth Science research. However, he has since told the Senate committee that he will support the agency's Earth Science mission. The MAIA instrument is predicted to go into space in 2021, and JPL hopes to publish the results in the next decade. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Tsutsui.
We've been reporting a lot these last few weeks about purple air. a brand of low-cost, Wi-Fi-enabled air quality monitors that are enabling concerned citizens across the world to crowdsource air quality data. After speaking with public agencies, academics, and advocacy groups about the promise of these devices, we were curious, who created Purple Air, and how did its product become so popular? FM89's Carrie Klein spoke with the entrepreneur who founded the company less than 3 years ago.
Adrian Dibwad, originally from South Africa, is today living outside Salt Lake City. He strikes me as a bit of an eccentric tech geek. He talks a lot about the Internet of Things, and I caught him while he and a coworker were taking his Tesla on a work trip to Southern California.
It's okay. The car drives itself. It's fun.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it was his coworker who was driving. Anyway, he began by giving me the Purple Air elevator pitch.
Our main mission, our main goal, has always been to monitor the air quality and to share that data openly and freely so others can actually analyze it to see if they agree that it looks sensible or come up with criticisms, and so it's available to the public. So I guess that for us is one of the most important mission statements, is open and free access to the data.
He says he came upon the idea for Purple Air accidentally. He lives near a large open-pit gravel mine and became concerned about air pollution.
We would always see every day the dust blowing over Bluffdale, the area below us, below the hill, and there was just a lot of dust, it seemed, every day, and I just wondered how much dust there really was.
Like many air quality advocates in the San Joaquin Valley, Dibwad didn't feel that regulatory air monitors were close enough to capture the particulate matter coming off the mine. So he decided to measure it himself. He began buying air sensors and testing them in his backyard. He started with infrared sensors, which wouldn't produce consistent results. Then, he says, he came across a different kind of sensor that uses lasers to count particles in the air.
That laser counter, I had seven of them on the desk in front of me, and they all seemed to agree with each other, which was the first time I'd seen that. So I took that as being meaningful, and then we started making those ones. It's quite a common laser counter. You can buy it off eBay. You can get it on Amazon. There's a bunch of different places on the internet that you can get it from the U.S. and from China. So it's one of the main kind of laser counter-based particle counters that are highly available on the internet.
These particle counters became the main component of Purple Air monitors. In each device, he packages two of those sensors alongside hardware that connects them to Wi-Fi in the Internet of Things.
That device sends that information to our little control board, which then averages it over some period of time and then transmits it to the website that you can send data to from any Internet of Things device, and they will help you to display it on a graph. And then we have a map that will display the real-time information to our users to see all of the air sensors together.
I was surprised to learn where he's making these devices. It's not in a factory or tech hub somewhere.
Right, so I have a couple of friends who come around and help me out from time to time when we've got parts, and we basically we took a PVC end cap from a plumbing store, and we drilled a hole or two and put a mounting bracket on it, and then we've got this special ring that's made out of PVC tubing that's made on a CNC machine, and that holds it all together. And so if you have a Purple Air sensor, it's been on our desk, and we've taped it up, and we've made it for you.
Dibwad started the company at home in 2015. Today, he's distributed more than 1,100 Purple Air monitors to dozens of countries around the world. I asked him if he thought this was where he'd be after just 2 years.
So I sort of figured that maybe we'd have 30 or something like that in the Salt Lake area. And past that, I didn't really have any plans or understanding of what we should be trying to do. We were just trying to, it started with trying to measure the air quality right here in our own backyard. And then kind of a situation where we put one down here, well, why don't we just put a couple in the rest of the Salt Lake Valley? And then people started wanting them. We were on Facebook and people started asking for them. And in the beginning, we were even giving them away free. So we must have installed about 80 in the beginning that were just given to people. So it was basically a hobby. And then it started drawing a bit more attention. And universities and other government organizations started being interested in trying them out. And a lot of those groups in the beginning compared them to their official EPA certified sensors in their own comparison. So they would run them next to it. So after that, it just started getting a life of its own, to the point where we really knew that we had to start selling them so that we could, you know, keep making them.
The devices themselves seem simple enough to make. I asked him if he's worried about being edged out by competition. The answer is complicated, partly because they're not really all that simple.
If you want to go and copy us and use the laser counter and create a map and create all of the upload mechanisms, there's a lot to it. And just writing the software for the front end on the map is a big part. Having somewhere to store the data for long enough, there's cost associated with that. Getting the testing done, getting the recognition, all of that is quite a big task. So if we were able to help someone else to do that and they become a competitor, well, that's also good for us, because now we've got two different companies using the same sensor, and then we can say, okay, well, their readings compare nicely to each other, or they don't. It gives more information. So there's such a big opportunity here that I think there's space for a couple of competitors in the market as well. So ultimately, the goal is to monitor the air. The goal is to have, you know, a lot of these throughout the world so that we can start collecting the data.
He says Purple Air's next steps are to automate manufacturing, scale it up, and create a more sustainable business model. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
And you can find our entire series on air quality and data from our Purple Air monitor, the one right outside our building in Clovis, on our website at kvpr.org. Well, that does it for today's Valley Edition broadcast. You can find our audio archives and our podcast as well at kvpr.org. And you can send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, or tweet us at kvpr and at Valley Edition. For Valley Edition's reporters, Laura Tsutsui, Christina Lopez, and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.